Folks, this is Screen Watching. It's our weekly discussion of what we've watched on the screens. My name's Dan, joined by Simon. Big week on the show, but before we get to any of that,
yes.
I mean, it's actually not putting it aside. This is on point. This is relevant. Mm-hmm. But who amongst us thought at the beginning of the year that LA Law star Corbin Burnson would walk away with the line of the year on television?
I know.
Okay. Which, I mean, first of all, who expects to see Corbin Burnson back on television? Yeah. But anyway, to hear him say the phrase on a television program, look at us, we're the cherry tomato boys. Oh my God, Simon, what a week this has been. Anyway, folks, we're going to explain what that's about in just a moment. But look, here's what we're doing on the show this week. We've got reviews. I'm going to take a look at the huge blockbuster TV series Monarch. And I've forgotten the rest of the title of it. It's Legacy of Monsters.
Legacy of Monsters.
This is a Godzilla, King Kong spin-off of sorts. And also, I'm going to talk about the new Nathan Fielder TV comedy. It's called The Curse, and it's got Corbin Burnson in it. But anyway, more on that in a moment. Simon, you've got some movies you're looking at.
Well, it's a very interesting week at the movies. Hello, Dan Barrett. Hello, everyone else. I went and saw, and I know this is one of your favorite words, the prequel to The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, long title, long movie. See if I lasted the distance. And I also went and saw a very unusual film called Saltburn, which is going to rock everyone's world, I hope. But I'll be talking about that a little bit later. I also caught up with the incredible Stop Making Sense and the 4K remaster at the IMAX here in Sydney, which was quite the movie-going experience. Had an incredible time there. What a great film.
Are you sponsored by the Sydney IMAX? I'm just, every time I turn on a podcast, I'm like, IMAX this, IMAX that. Simon, it's not even as big as it used to be. Jeez.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television, teacher, mother.
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Dudes, ladies, fellow countrymen, this is Screen Watching. It's a big week. We've got those reviews. We talked about them. Simon, we've got a guest this week.
How do we get guests? Who wants to come on this show? I'll tell you who. Simon Marauder. He is a critic of some note, and he's authored a book called The Book of the Banned, which looks at Australia's history with censorship. And talks about some of the crazy cases that the censorship team have put themselves in. He's going to be our intermission today. We'll be crossing to him live.
It stinks.
Godzilla, Kong, pick a side. This series doesn't. It plays it straight down the middle. It's called Monarch, Legacy of Monsters.
Monarch was there in San Francisco. When the whole city was coming down, these guys were taking pictures like they'd been waiting for it.
You think that your father was working for them?
This stuff wasn't as safe.
Who are they?
What's Monarch? There's a new
welcome. This is the world we live in. Monsters are an inescapable reality. And it's so strong.
Those files belong to us, and they are more important than you could possibly imagine.
So, Simon, my general feelings on the U.S. legendary run MonsterVerse, it's been patchy. There have been some really good films. There's been some outright terrible movies. Most of the terrible films have had the word Godzilla in them. The good films have had the title King Kong in them. Maybe it's a bias. I don't think it is. I think they were just bad Godzilla movies. That said, they've got a new TV series, which is on Apple TV Plus. I was a little bit surprised to think about a Godzilla TV series. Could it be done in a way that makes sense on, like, for Americans? Like, you know, we've seen Japanese TV shows where people dress up in giant suits and crash around on a TV budget. It's been done. It's fine. Like, I enjoy those shows.
Sure.
Yeah. No, nobody's watched more episodes of Ultra 7 than I have. But thinking about this, I was just a little bit skeptical. I'm going to say the series, it works an absolute treat. The premise of the series is this. Set across two different time periods. We're in the 60s. We're in the modern era. We've got young Kurt Russell. We've got old Kurt Russell. I guess young Kurt Russell is named Wyatt Russell, but you know, he's an actor in his own
literally
right.
Literally young
he's fine.
Kurt Russell.
He's no Kurt Russell, but you know.
No, he's not yet.
Who is? But they're playing the same character. So we're seeing the Lee Shaw character as played by a young man. And I said the 60s, but I think it's actually the 50s that we see that character.
Goes way back, yeah.
Pretty sure. But anyway, I should have written some notes. But anyway, in the 50s, we start with an intrepid trio of people that bump into each other in a forest. They've heard about these monsters, and so they've gone hunting. Monster hunting, I think is the phrase. There you've got Wyatt Russell. You've got Anna Sawai and Sawai. And then also from TV show, gosh, I just forgot the name of the show. I was just trying to even do it. I've even met this guy. Shocking. Anders Holm, who people would know from Workaholics. But anyway, the three of them are out there. They're monster hunting. Did you not realize who Anders Holm was?
No, not a fan. I had seen Workaholics, but I didn't put it together. Those three are terrific together. It's the heart of the show. They're really good.
Yeah, great trio. And we know sort of pretty early in that two of them are going to hook up, and the other one is the Kurt Russell, Wyatt Russell character. So anyway, we've got that. But then we got three generations later, like the grandkids of the progeny, I guess. They are now involved in our own sort of monster thing. Godzilla's gone public. Okay. We saw the events of this in the, 2016 Godzilla movie called Godzilla? I think that was the name of it. It may not have been. I don't know. Did not care for that movie at all.
Oh, no. I'm loving the Godzilla films.
I don't know. No, it was politely, it was fucking awful. It was a really terrible movie, but not as bad as the second Godzilla movie they made after that, which was way worse. But anyway, we see the events of that film take place, but from a different perspective. Instead of watching it from the Godzilla point of view, we're seeing it very much from the ground, and we're seeing it from the point of view of a young school teacher in San Francisco whose entire life has been upended by what is referred to as G-Day. Now, this is obviously Godzilla Day for people within the world of this and for most countries watching it. But just quietly, we're here in Australia, so Godzilla Day, as far as I'm concerned, is G'day.
Nice.
We've got this taking place. And what I think this does, Simon, is it places the Godzilla mythos and the entire monsterverse in a range of terms that we as viewers are really able to appreciate, because it is from the everyday schmo's point of view. We can see how something like a Godzilla attack on a city can impact on an individual person, a family, relationships, whatever, because we explore that through the series. We've got this sort of Wyatt Russell character. I guess maybe the sort of minor spoiler, but if you're paying attention to names, you'll pick up on it pretty quickly. I mentioned Anders Holm. The character that he's playing is the younger version of the John Goodman character from the Kong. What was that one called? The one in the 70s that was like a Acropolis Now. Sorry, Apocalypse Now. Not Acropolis Now. That'd be an entirely different movie.
And we see John Goodman at the start of this series doing his bit with a giant monster beastie. So it's good. It's great to see him back on screen.
Yeah, but even though there's a whole lot of flashbacks and flash forwards, don't expect to see John Goodman again. And you probably won't see Brie Larson or anything like that either. Simon, the first five episodes have been provided to critics. I will say I've watched all five episodes. I enjoyed four of them. One of them, it does something. I don't want to give any spoilers though, so I'm not going to sort of badmouth it too much. But four of the five I thought exceptionally good. The only thing that kind of bothers me with the show a little bit is that it works very much in a post-Lost TV environment where they feel that they need to flash forward and flash back and fill in every bit of backstory to a character. I'd prefer they're not doing that. I'd prefer to see something a little bit more linear, or maybe just even something where I don't mind a little bit of exposition. I don't need to watch the entire hour to find out how Jack got his back tattoo. Like, that isn't necessarily needed for me to be entertained by something. So I'd prefer that this show didn't go down that Lost route and have every episode as seen through the eyes of one of the characters and it flashes backwards. I'm hoping that the back end of the season five steers away from that sort of story structure a bit. But by and large, if you're bringing a Godzilla TV show to the small screen, they've done it marvelously. I keep referring to it as the Godzilla show. It's certainly got Godzilla as a framing device as to why these characters have all got trauma and been brought together. but every episode they go and explore like another giant monster from somewhere else. It is globe-trotting, it is good special effects, it is great human drama, really accessible, interesting, fun cast. I love it.
Yeah, look, I'm two episodes in and I thought it was a terrific opening episode. That scene that has been bandied about a bit in the sort of promotion of it, the young lady with the school bus and Godzilla looks down at her, it's a terrific special effect, and it's a great bit of composition. It's one of the, it's a truly iconic sort of Godzilla shot, Godzilla framing. And as you say, he doesn't play a huge part in it, but the shadow of Godzilla is all over this series and also all over the people of the world. The bunkers that they have to run to if they get a Godzilla alarm or a Kaiju alarm, they run down to the subways, is a really interesting way that they look at life post G-Day. So yeah, look, I thought this was terrific. I can't wait to see the rest of the episodes and how it all unfolds. Big Godzilla fan.
Yeah, and obviously because it's a Apple TV Plus show, fairly good budget to it, which means there's a bit of shooting on location around the place, bit of action in Japan, bit of action in US, like it is all over the place and really delivers. For fans of comic book narrative fiction, probably worth noting that one of the co-showrunners on this is Matt Faction, who is a luminary within the comic book medium from definitely the last like 10 years or so. Anyway, really nice guy. I interviewed him once for one of my former podcasts. Great guy, and it's really exciting to see him sort of involved in this because he brings some pretty big but also fairly human ideas, and I think that's really evident from the show we're watching on screen.
And I should point out that it is a fairly big month for all things Godzilla related. I'll be attending the premiere of Godzilla Minus One, which is the first Toho Studios Godzilla movie since 2016's Shin Godzilla. And that'll be screened at Sydney's home of Movie Go in the IMAX Theatre down at Darling Harbour in Sydney. Catch the 454 bus down to there to see all things IMAX.
I would also like to just advise people that Simon looks at things only through his prism, and this is actually getting a release for people other than Simon as well.
Oh, very much so. Yes, no, it will be going to cinemas. So, good one. I'm going to move on to the prequel of the week. It's called The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes.
The Hunger Games, they're to punish the districts. Those tributes don't have a choice.
Your role is to turn these children into spectacles, not survivors.
We're live.
Smile. It's why we have teeth.
We join the world of the Hunger Games 64 years before Jennifer Lawrence's Katniss Everdeen volunteered as a tribute, and several decades before Donald Sutherland's Coriolanus Snow became the president of Panem. The main character in The Hunger Games, the song Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, is a young Donald Sutherland. He's played by a very dashing Tom Blythe, who looks nothing like a young Donald Sutherland. He looks more like a young Peter O'Toole, far too good looking to be anything young Donald Sutherland-y. But he is a man who holds the very last hopes for his failing family empire, his family lineage. The once proud Snow family has fallen from grace in a post-war capital. With his livelihood threatened, he's assigned to mentor a young lady called Lucy Gray Baird, played by the wonderful Rachel Zegler. She's a tribute from the impoverished District 12. He can see in her an opportunity to build the Hunger Games up into something even bigger, to restore the glory that was the Hunger Games for years. But he also falls in love with her, as they do in these sort of movies. And what unfolds is a pretty convincing, if tragically overlong, prequel that puts into perspective the years building up to the Hunger Games as we came to know it, first through the books and then through the films. Never read the books, enjoyed all the films. It's clearly one of the better YA literary adaptations. This one is filmed in three chapters. And I get the sense that it was going to be two films, but they decided at the last minute to cram that third film into the final chapter of this film, because it really does tie together at the end of the second chapter. but then blows off into a whole other storyline, which it's hard to keep momentum. That's when you really start to feel the pace, when you're not quite as engaged with that last storyline. But the first two chapters are terrific. Good cast in this. Peter Dinklage plays the head of the school that Coriolanus Snow is a member of, and he sort of rules over this with an iron fist. He's clearly got issues with the Snow family, and he wants to keep them in their place. Also chewing the scenery all the way through this is Viola Davis. Oh, boy, does she chew the scenery. But she provides a lot of fun for those along the way. I don't think it's going to win over any new Hunger Game fans. I don't know how engaged with the franchise you were at any given point. But I kind of dug it, and I saw it on IMAX. So it was a good time all around.
I saw all three, but I guess it's technically four movies when they came out in the cinema. I was eagerly getting along to them. I didn't think they were great films, but they were great Saturday morning, like, fun movies. So I'd go along on a Saturday morning with low expectations and just have a great time at the movies, look forward to the next one. I've got zero interest in seeing this movie at all. Like, they've done nothing at all to tell me why I should be interested in this or even give me, like, the smallest thing to grab onto. Like, it feels like there's a movie coming out and I just know nothing about it and I don't care.
This one, I get the sense that this one is skewing even younger than the original Hunger Games did. They tried to, I think they'd be very happy with this, although it's a very expensive film by all accounts. I think they would be happy to get the core young female audience in to see this and not have that huge crossover success that they had with the Jennifer Lawrence films. They've brought back the director, Francis Lawrence. He did, I'm a bit caught out here, I think he did a couple of the, oh yeah, Gary Ross did the first one and then Francis Lawrence did the next bunch. He's a good director. He did the Keanu Reeves film Constantine. He did Will Smith's I Am Legend, so he knows how to draw tension out of futuristic settings and monsters and intrigue and that sort of stuff. And he brings all of that to this. And he's also got Jason Schwartzman on board in this, who provides a few laughs as well as sort of the character that was played by Stanley Tucci in the film. So all the elements are there. The film delivers. It feels a little overlong, but I was pleasantly surprised by the impact it had. So it's in cinemas everywhere this week, The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes.
Meanwhile, I just continue to be baffled as to why do IP mining and revivals for properties when your audience isn't the people that actually know the IP and have engaged with that IP before. Baffling.
It's a good point. It is a good point.
Yeah. Anyway, Simon, let's move on to... it's not the TV show of the year, but it's maybe the experience of the year. It's the new Nathan Fielder. Is it even a comedy? Look, it's a TV show. It is something which you will watch on your screen at home. It's called The Curse.
There's no such thing as a perfect city, but to me, this city is as close as it comes. That's why we're proud to call Espanola my home. Oh, shit. Our home.
All right, you got it. Okay. Hard.
This isn't your typical home flipping show.
My homes are reflecting the local community.
Come on.
And we're husband and wife.
This is kind of rad.
So what could go wrong?
Let's grab a quick shot of you giving money to that little girl over there.
We're doing good here. We are good people.
Thank you.
We're really good.
Okay, so the way this is being sold is that it's a satire of what they – it's a bit hard to talk about in Australia, but like an HGTV-style home and renovation-type program. So these are the sorts of programs that we get here on Foxtel.
Big coffee.
It's the sort of show we get here on Foxtel. Like, it's very American and very formatted, and usually you see a pair of Americans who have some sort of project they're involved in over the course of a season – and so they revitalize like a small town or like an old farmhouse or, you know, a backyard or a school playground or whatever. So that's the premise. And so with this, you've got Nathan Fielder playing a very Nathan Fielder type character. He's got his wife, Emma Stone, playing a character who, look, both of them are fairly despicable for various reasons. He's just generally just a bit despicable and awful. So broadly, they are the project they're involved in is they've invested some time in a fairly rundown Hispanic neighborhood, and the idea is that they want to gentrify the hell out of it. What they haven't sort of admitted to anyone outside of those in their sort of inner circle, they've bought a lot of property in the area, and so their TV show, not only do they want to gentrify the area, but they want to make a lot of money off property while they're also doing this. Now, the Emma Stone character is, on the face of her, a fairly caring sort of heartfelt person. But also, as you sort of tend to sort of gleam into the idea, she doesn't actually really care about anything. I think she's a bit dead inside, but she's got a lot of social media followers and she doesn't want to disappoint them. Now, there's two levels of truth being played. There's the truth of what they're doing in terms of their business work and their HGTV style TV program. But then you've got the other side of it, which is their personal life. They would like to start a family, but they haven't been all that sort of sexually engaged. And part of the reason for it is that the Nathan Fielder character has a micro penis. Now, this is the thing. I've never seen a micro penis in real life or on television before, but I've certainly ticked one of those two off now. It was unexpected. Now,
it was unexpected.
When it happened, I thought to myself, you know what? That's a really interesting character quirk. Okay, it's interesting that they're just going to do this and be really subtle and just sort of give this as backstory as to why this is, I don't want to use words like cuck. That's not where I want to go, Simon. But I just did it. I think I just said it. He's definitely a man who is taking a secondary back position to his wife. And part of that is possibly to do with confidence issues related to his micro penis. Anyway, I thought that was going to be a subtle sort of a commentary, but they really just double down on it the point where, and as I said, like there's elements of truth and who's telling truth and who's not. When you get to the relationship the Emma Stone character has with her parents, and we find out that while she may be a fairly duplicitous person in her day-to-day dealings, she tends to share everything with her family. So there's some very awkward scenes where the parents are talking around the fact that her husband has a micro penis. It's very awkward, leading to an amazing sequence where Corbin Burnson, who plays the father, is more or less trying to tell him that having a micro penis isn't such a bad issue and that he's not necessarily particularly well endowed himself. And as someone who is concurrently watching LA Law with Corbin Burnson as the sex machine Arnie Becker, it was definitely hard for me to compute that these two things were existing in my head at pretty much the exact same time.
It is such a bizarre show.
This show, I think I've sold it as being more watchable than it is, okay? If you're familiar with the works of Nathan Fielder, you kind of get what you're probably in for with this. It is very slow and awkward with lots of pregnant pauses, pregnant expanding well beyond 9 months. Like, it's about 3 years worth of pregnant pause in between every pause. Like, it is very deliberate and very specific. And if you're into Nathan Fielder, I think this is absolutely a must watch. If you are a casual TV viewer, I think you will wonder what the hell it is you're watching. You'll definitely make it through to the first episode, but will you come back for repeat engagements? I'm not so sure. And for me, I probably straddle somewhere between the two. I really like Nathan Fielder, but I can find it's a little bit much at times. And so for me, I think I need maybe a month between episodes. So I'll be back. I just need some time. Anyway, the show, it's called The Curse. You can find it on Paramount Plus. Watch it at your peril.
It is such a anxiety-inducing show. It is a series that dwells in the most awkward and uncomfortable moments in life and the life that they have created for themselves. Emma Stone's terrific in the part. Everyone on board is really good. We should point out the curse in the title is an incident that happens when he's in a car park and for his camera, he gives some money to a young girl, but when the camera's turned off, he wants the $100 back, so he grabs it off her and she puts a curse on her. Now, I've only seen the one episode and that hasn't played into that any further other than it sort of inspires them to do some awful things. But everything they do in their lives inspires them to do further awful things in the show. So, yeah, you're right. It's an awkward watch. It's a painful watch at times. It's a very funny one as well. I certainly laughed out loud on a few occasions, but only because I couldn't believe where they went with some of their comedies. So, yes, The Curse, watch it if you dare.
Absolutely. Was that a recommendation? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I got off to the movies and saw Saltburn.
Did you know there was a college Christmas party tonight? NFI, me and you. Not fucking invited. You all right?
Yeah, I've got a flat tire.
Take my bike.
Hey, that was so kind. Thank you. I'm sorry I don't know your name. I'm Felix.
Oliver.
Oliver. Oliver, I love you. I love you. All right, cheers, Ollie!
My parents, they've got problems.
What kind of? What do you mean, problems?
I don't think I'll ever go home again.
Well, why don't you come home with me? Come to Saltburn.
Saltburn is the sophomore effort for a lady named Emerald Fennell. She burst on the scene a couple of years ago with Promising Young Woman. And I was very concerned that the sophomore curse for the young filmmaker would set in when I settled in to watch Saltburn. She's written and directed this one as well. This is the story of a young student, an Oxford University student named Oliver Quick, played by the terrific Barry Keoghan. He's a bit of an outsider as he presents himself. He makes friends with the very dashing, very high society dude, Felix Carlton, played by Jacob Elordi. And when Jacob finds, when Felix finds out that Oliver is going to be alone for the downtime during the school terms, he decides to invite the young man back to the family estate, which is the Saltburn of the title. Once Oliver's sort of caught up in the middle of this family and their very well-to-do existence, he sets about dismantling it in only the way he can. This beautiful looking film, and it is a stunningly shot film, presented in what they call the Academy ratio, which is like the square screen, the old TV screen. It is a satire on the rich and the upper class, but it's also a takedown of the sociopaths that will take advantage of these upper class attitudes and upper class ways of life to get their own ways as well. Barry Keoghan is extraordinary in the lead. This movie sort of moves along at an uncomfortable clip for about 40 minutes, and you're kind of wondering, yes, I'm absolutely hooked. These characters and these actors are terrific. You've also got Rosamund Pike in there, Richard E. Grant, Archie Madakwe, who we know from the Gran Turismo film from a couple of months back. And then a scene occurs. Well, let's just call it the bathtub scene for now. And you realize that this is a movie that could go in any direction to tell the story, kind of giving off the same sort of vibes as the curse that we were just talking about. It is an uncomfortable watch. It's an awkward watch at times, filled with anxiety and filled with an immorality that you rarely see portrayed on screen. This is a truly independent work, and Emerald Fennell has made a better second film than her first film, Promising Young Woman. So Saltburn's, once again, like The Curse, not going to be everyone's cup of tea, and even those that get along to it may find it hard to connect with. But if you need something a bit off-center and a bit challenging to watch, then Saltburn's definitely it.
Yeah, I quite liked her first film, Promising Young Woman, but I wasn't really gaga for it. But I really like her. I've heard her talk about movies quite a fair bit on various podcasts around the place. And she's so switched on that like I'm very much in scenist. But as I said, I did quite like Promising Woman. And
she turns out to be a great visual storyteller as well, which was touched on in Promising Young Woman, but she's given full rein to do some amazing work and capture some amazing images in Saltburn. So and Barry Keoghan, he once again delivers as the most unlikeliest of leading men, but he's great in this. God, but yes, the bathtub scene and then subsequent scenes that will shock and amuse you are guaranteed. Called Saltburn. I think it's only in limited release now, which hasn't gone out wide, but hopefully it'll. I don't know if the Academy will go for it. I don't know if it's an Oscar nomination kind of film. It's a little bit too challenging in that regard. But try and get along to see it, especially on the big screen.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
That That's right, Dan Barrett. We are now well into the intermission section of the show. We have a guest today, and I'm very excited to have him on the show. He's a man whose writings I've respected for many years as a film critic. Now he's written a book called The Book of the Damned. In fact, I'll get the full title for you. Book of the Damned, Devilish Movies, Dastardly Censors, and the Scenes That Made Australia Sweat. Welcome to the show, Simon Morotto. How are you, mate?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure to chat with you, my friend. Congratulations on the book. So what I thought we'd do, we'd have a bit of a chat about some of your, the great moments in your book, some of the great moments in sort of censorship, and I use the term great advisedly, and also where exactly we're at with censorship in Australia. Let's have a little bit of a chat about where the idea for the book came from.
Yeah, it's an interesting one where I probably had the seed of the idea in my head for like 15 years,
wow.
Well, 10 years rather, right? Because it took me 4 years to write the book. So I'm sort of adding a few years to that. But when I started as a film critic in 2008, I was in my very early 20s, and in close succession, the movies The Hangover and Borat came out. And again, critic in his early 20s, you know, I was into those movies and nothing wrong with them. But the point being is I was deeply invested in them. And I discovered at the time that both of the films, The Hangover and Bruno, came to Australian cinemas having been trimmed by the distributor, right? So there was a couple of sequences that earned the films R ratings. And the distributors, because they wanted to get more bums on seats and get more teenage guys and girls into the cinema, they cut out the offending parts and got MA ratings. Mm. And I thought, well, this is a high crime, right? Like, this is unacceptable that they would deny us the full glimpse of Bruno and The Hangover. And in my naive state, I thought this is the greatest tragedy of them all. And then I discovered, actually, while it's unfortunate, it's actually part of a century-long trend in Australian cinema that continues through to 2023 today. Mm-hmm. But that was, weirdly enough, the seed of inspiration, or at least for me, to become aware of this, literally the length of Federated Australia. That's the length of this trend in our country.
It infuriates me. I read the part in your book where they cut some scenes from the recent horror film Megan out, and as you say, it's been going on for a long, long time. Let's talk about some famous moments of censorship. In my formative years, the two really big ones were Hail Mary, when Goddard's film about the sort of the contemporary spin on the Virgin Mary myth was banned, and there were protests outside the State Theatre and all that. Mm. And of course, Margaret's, and your chapter 4, Are You There, Margaret? It's Us, the Police, about the Ken Park screening in Balmain. I remember that vividly. Do you have some favourites from the book that sort of sum up why people should be reading this tome?
Well, and like you said before, great moments in censorship, favourite moments. We say it with our tongue planted in cheek, right?
Yeah,
because,
exactly.
But you kind of have to, and that's the interesting thing. When looking at the history of censorship of film specifically in Australia, you know, there's censorship of film in basically every nation in the world. Some have it far worse than us, some not so bad. But what kept drawing me to this, you know, this idea that there's a book in this, is that the Australian efforts kind of wind up being these absurd, like, farces. You know, the Ken Park example is one of my favorites, actually. And I spoke to Margaret for the book, you know, talking about how the police storm on stage to turn off the DVD player that's showing the film. So she just turns it back on. And then the police turn it off again and she turns it back on. And so then they cut the power to the building, but now they can't eject the DVD. So this kind of farce occurs on the stage at the Balmain Town Hall, which I find amusing. The Hail Mary screening that was picketed, you know, I've got a quote in the book about someone who was struck in the head by something that was thrown at the Prime Minister at the time who was in attendance. And there are all these terrible moments in the theatre as well, where there was a play, oh gosh, I've forgotten the name of the play now. I think it's called America Huzzah or Hurrah. But effectively, there's a scene where these puppets are on stage. It's called Motel. That's my memory. These puppets are on stage speaking, swearing, drawing obscenities on the wall, and the police rush the stage to arrest the puppets. And and they go backstage and they find that actually the actors in the puppet suits, they've all stripped down to their underwear. So they don't know who was actually the ones on stage, and they don't know where the puppets are because they've been hidden. So all these moments, like they seem invented and silly and fake, but they're sort of, you know, they're comical, but they're still authoritarian, which is the kind of freaky and frightening part of it.
Something that I really liked about the book was you made this really deliberate choice, or at least I presume it's deliberate. Maybe you didn't think about it in the slightest, but it appeared deliberate, where the language in it is very earthy and accessible, but also you drop in a few swears and some very salty, earthy language throughout it. And for a book which is about censorship, it just kind of feels as though it was great to see a warts and all book that's being presented to the people. And I'm just wondering about the thinking that went behind, like, the language used in the book.
No, that's I really appreciate you saying that. And that was a definite consideration for me, because I'm by no means an absolutely anything goes, let's put it out there advocate, right? I'm absolutely anti-censorship when it comes to films. I do appreciate there's a really important role that the classification board plays in terms of, you know, what is censored. And I talk about the, you know, the footage of the Christchurch massacre early in the book that has to be viewed and banned by the board. That's how our law works here, right? But it was definitely a conscious effort. You know, I didn't, part of my frustration, and again, the reason behind I wanted to write the book, was there was all this discussion about censorship in Australian cinema in the 1970s. And that's when Don Chipp, as customs minister at the time, really pushed for, and we got an R rating. And there was a bit more discussion in the early 2000s when, you know, Margaret had the Ken Park screening. And then there hadn't been anything for about 15, 20 years outside of the academic space. And I didn't want to, you know, write a thesis. I didn't want to, you know, do my doctorate on this subject. I'm not saying I would have gotten my doctorate, but I didn't want to write an academic text that would just sort of sit in a library somewhere, as valuable as that may have been. I wanted people to know about the history, know about the current state of things, and become, you know, drawn in by the salaciousness of the subject matter, knowing that I didn't want to be mealy-mouthed in how we talk about sex and violence and coarse language, but knowing that it is dealing with some pretty gnarly topics. So, you know, I ultimately put a content warning at the top of the book, because I think it's fair for people to appreciate that we are going to get stuck into some heady and earthy language and themes, but I didn't want to pull my punches, I guess, when we come to talking about it.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing that really sort of struck me was reading the book, it's not just a history of, you know, censorship, it's a history of Australian culture and our relationship to culture. So you go out of your way very early in to say that if you ask your average man on the street, is Australian film censored, like the average man on the street would be like, oh mate, no, not at all, we're living in Australia. But you actually take those steps really early into the book to establish that context of the what we see as Australia in the modern era is not really necessarily the Australia of, you know, even 20, 30 years ago. Really, we have been a heavily censored country. And throughout the book, my jaw was dropping just at what I thought was relative of, like, recent history. I mean, older than me being on this earth, but still relatively new, that there was that level of censorship at play.
Yeah, I'm really glad you noted that. And that was actually the kind of the crystallizing moment for me was there's a version of this book when I first started writing it in 2019 or started, you know, compiling it. It was basically going to be a dictionary, right? It was going to be a chronological or alphabetical. Here are the movies that were cut or banned. Here are the scenes that were cut or banned. And just being this kind of like capturing this lost diary of, you know, movie moments that were denied Australians. And the clarifying moment, and it only came in about 2022, when I was, you know, finally had done a lot of interviews, realizing that actually censorship in Australia kicked off prior to the advent of the first feature film, The Story of the Kelly Gang. It really emerged in 1886. And then you think about the history of Federated Australia kicking off in 1901 and how you can basically line the timeline of Australia, and I'm talking again Federated Australia, you can put that timeline up against the history of cinema. And so suddenly you had this story of Australia that was also the story of cinema and how our national identity has been tied to it. And the bushranging genre, you know, the fact that we made the first feature film in Australia with the story of the Kelly Gang, and that bushranging films were the first Australian genre. They were hits, and immediately the censors got to work on them. New South Wales Parliament passed legislation banning the depiction of New South Wales police officers on film because they were fearful of how we were being depicted, or that they were being depicted. This is all pre-ANZAC, right? This is all pre-digger identity. We have considered ourselves bushrangers from day dot in Federated Australia, but we're not. We're cops. That's ultimately who we are as a culture and an identity. And that's really the angle of the book that I wanted to convey.
Yeah, there's also the idea of Australia being sexist cops. So one of the things, and you don't really sort of like just explicitly say it, but like it's pretty clear in the text, you talk about some of the earlier censorship boards, and a lot of it always began with some sort of women's group of censorship. And then when it actually became like a legitimized like censorial board, it was all dudes. Like suddenly men just sort of took over, saying, you know, this is sort of our responsibility, and just pushed the women to the back. So it's just kind of interesting, the idea that concerns about culture probably were coming from these sort of women orientated social groups rather than the government necessarily having its authority that it wanted to impose from the beginning.
That's also part of just how wowser groups and pressure groups have evolved in Australia.
The word wowser came from because of this book. Like, I didn't realize that wowser was as relatively new a term as it was. I thought it was, you know, coined well and truly beyond. I wrote a note about this. It was like 1912. And it's an acronym which I didn't know. It stood for We Only Want Social Evils Remedied. Like, incredible. I never learned that in grade 10.
It's a great, it's such a funny, clumsy acronym as well. Like,
I was struggling.
I think it feels like one of those acronyms where they worked backward from wowser. They're like, we really like this word wowser. How can we make it stand for something? But the WA Premier of the time, John Scadden, this is, I think, 1914 or thereabouts, he said, wowsers are the kind of people who are more insulted by a glimpse of miniskirt than by a mountain of misery. And I think that's the better description of them ultimately. But certainly those pressure groups, when they began, they were women's groups. You know, they are these, you know, the Good Film League, which was an offshoot of a women's group. And ultimately, over time, they, I guess, as culture shifted, those pressure groups became more specifically right wing and more religious, or, you know, hard right religious. And then you had folks like Fred Nile coming to the fore. And still today, you know, there have been groups like Family Voice Australia and Collective Shout, and they sort of vary in what their makeup is, but their angles are all fairly similar. And the really scary part, and, you know, maybe it's a bit of a stretch, but part of my ultimate conclusion of this book is these pressure groups, they make their bones by decrying films and saying, look at how culture, Hollywood, whomever, look at how they're trying to corrupt your kids. And they build up their mailing lists and they gain their followers from common sense people who are like, yeah, that's, I don't know why the filmmakers or these so-called artists are trying to corrupt our families. And then they parlay that reputation that Fred Nile earned in the 70s and Collective Shout earned in the early 2000s. They parlay it into these greater, more damaging cultural wars. And these are the bodies that fight against marriage equality, that were absolutely fighting against the recent, you know, referendum on an Indigenous voice to Parliament. We see that recurring over and over again, even with trans rights today. So again, I kind of feel like movie censorship is a bit of the canary in the coal mine for Australian culture at large.
Yeah. Well, you kind of think about a lot of the grassroots sort of lobbying by these groups to try to censor films as being a very American thing, but obviously there's this Australian history of doing this. But largely, a lot of our culture that we're seeing through screen culture is derived from the US. And I kind of thought it was interesting highlighting really early in the book again that there's actually benefits to what the censorship board are doing, that they're not necessarily just there to stop people from being able to see stuff, which isn't really their aim anyway. It's kind of, you know, that giving a rating so people can make their own choice on something. But whatever that rating is can limit where something is distributed and can cut off access. But they're not just sort of worried about that. They're actually making sure that it is in line with Australian standards and not necessarily in line with US standards. So you make the notion there about Netflix as setting a lot of the global consumption that's taking place, but a lot of that global consumption is based on American morals and where they set the yardstick as opposed to Australia. And just interesting to note, the Australians were setting its own yardstick to make sure that we're keeping our purity where we want it to sit.
Yeah, and that's sort of the scary state of things today, which is because of the streaming services, especially like Netflix, where they create, you know, so much content, they were able to convince the Australian government to let them classify their own films from America for the Australian market. And I spoke with Margaret Anderson, who's a great character in the book. She's the former director of the classification board, came from the penal system, came from the world of classifying prisoners for maximum, minimum, and medium security prisons, effectively. And she was basically decrying Netflix's approach, because they're looking at films or rating them for an Australian audience, but with their American mores. And the example she cites is High Flying Bird, the Steven Soderbergh film. That was rated M. That's an M-rated movie. Totally fine. But the Americans rated it M for nudity. And then Margaret and the other classifiers were going, what are they talking about? Where's the nudity in this film? And it's based on a scene where Kyle MacLachlan goes to a sauna and has a towel around his waist. So the nudity in that film is a man with his shirt off. Because in Netflix headquarters or wherever, they're just adding meta tags to it. They're not considering what it means in Australia or in the UK or what have you. And there are a number of films that they reclassified, which is actually a crime. It is illegal to do that in Australia. But they mistakenly reclassified a bunch of movies that are already being classified. And in each case, they put it one grade higher. So suddenly Moonlight, which is M in Australia, was MA on Netflix. Halloween, the David Gordon Green remake, that's MA in Australia. It was suddenly R on Netflix. Now, what is the difference beyond the person classifying it? And I think that's such an interesting way to suggest, well, that's how mores are shifting. And we really need to be able to, you know, the classification board is maybe a necessary evil to at least have some on the ground perspective of what an Australian audience needs and wants to see.
Well, you also have to think that the reason why Netflix are probably setting things slightly further above is because Netflix as a body want to cut down the number of customer complaints they have. So for the very small number of customers they have that are worried about the ratings and the way things have been classified on platform, if they step it that little bit further back, it means fewer phone calls and emails coming through they have to worry about. So there's an economic imperative for them to rate things just that little bit beyond, which doesn't actually benefit us here in Australia, but certainly benefits their bottom line with how much money and resource they need to invest in that response.
At the end of the day, though, the complaints, they go to ACMA, or they go to the classification board themselves, they go to the Australian government, because Netflix have been given that approval. And I should also say that the really scary part of this is that based on that pilot, the Australian government also are now trialing a tool called Spherix, which I talk about towards the end of the book, which is an AI, it's AI technology that says, okay, we'll plug in a film and we'll consider through machine learning the cultural and social mores of 300 countries across the world and produce ratings for each nation out of this one central point. Now, that is weird and a bit scary because, again, what is the benefit here for an Australian audience, especially when cultural mores are so unique and you ultimately, I think, do need a person to apply context to why a film is, why it's transgressive or why it's actively trying to be in bad taste. I mean, how does a machine classify appropriately the films of John Waters? It doesn't work that way. And the history of the classification board, they've always wanted it to be representative of the community, which is fair. And I appreciate where they're coming from. They want to measure and grade against community standards. But where are the thinkers of film, the critiques and the critics of art who can say, look, absolutely, this film should not be seen by people under the age of 18 because it has X, Y, and Z. But we don't need to ban it. We don't need to refuse classification because there is something here. There's an art form that's being utilized to convey a message of meaning, good or bad, whether they're doing it successfully is sort of by the by. We've really lacked that on the classification board over the years?
We've managed to have this whole discussion without really talking about the specifics of what have got certain films banned. I think as offensive as we've got is talking about Kyle MacLachlan with his shirt off. So I want to talk very briefly about the film that was banned for 10,000 days over 35 years in Australia, and that was Salo or the 120 Days of Sodom, the Pasolini film, which was based on a book that was also banned here in Australia for obscenity. It is one of only two films that have made me dry reach watching a movie. The other one was Jackass 3 when they drank the spit.
That's the 3D one as well.
That's the 3D one. It made me gag. But 120 Days of Sodom certainly had me in that film. How do you look at the role that film played in helping to define censorship in Australia?
Oh, what an interesting question. I don't think it's played... let me rephrase that. So what role has it played in defining censorship? I would love to say that Salo, which is, you know, for those who haven't seen it, one of the most transgressive pieces of art, but cinema, that's ever been made. It is absolute, like it literally ticks all, like every box. There is not a box. I invent some new ones, right? So, and that's why it exists. That's the other thing to note. It exists to tick those boxes and to push the viewer. I would love to say that was the film that came out and in Australia or globally, the scales fell off classifiers and censors' eyes and they said, right, this is a powerful piece of art. It is not for everyone, but there is an important message here about fascism and about authoritarian power. And for a discerning audience, it deserves to be seen. Now, as I talk about in the book, and we'll talk about Australia specifically, it was banned. Then it was unbanned. Then a censored version was released. Then that version was banned. And that dance kind of continued for 30 odd years until 2010, when it was ultimately released in Australia on DVD and Blu-ray and screened in some cinemas. And the condition was it had to be released with making of documentary that, you know, basically reiterated, this is not real. It is a movie. We are going to spell out to you what this movie is trying to say. That's the only condition it could be released in Australia. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened? Not a whole lot. And when I reinvestigated with Accent Films and Shock, who were distributing it in Australia, they basically said, look, we've just down to runoff stock at this point. There's no demand for Salo, which I understand as well. Mm-hmm. But by effectively censoring it over the years and this war raging on, it actually, you want to think that it increased interest in the movie. It really diminished it by not having it in the cultural sphere. There was no public domain discussion of Salo occurring because no one could see the bloody thing. Mm. So where we are today is it's actually very hard to get a hold of Salo on DVD or it's not available to stream or available digitally because there's no demand for it. You can go and watch it online. I'm sure we have, you can access remote servers and VPNs and what have you. You can see Salo if you want to see it. But the act of censorship, I wish I could say that the volume of censorship enrages people and it hits a breaking point and we all go, no more, let us see Salo. But the reality is you take these films out of the sphere, people don't know what they don't know. And that is a film whose legacy is dead in Australia, at the very least.
Mate, you've written such a fascinating book, Book of the Ban, Devilish Movies, Dastardly Censors, and the Scenes That Made Australia Sweat. Simon Morta, thanks so much for joining us here. Where can people get the book? Available at all good booksellers and quite a few bad ones, as they used to say?
Yeah, the bad ones, just got to tell them to order it. But otherwise, you can get it at bookoftheband.com as well. And Google it. You'll be able to find it pretty quickly.
Thank you, mate. Congratulations on the book. It's a joy to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me, folks.
Thanks, Simon. Now, after that great chat, which we absolutely haven't recorded after we've recorded this, what I'm interested in, Simon, is a little thing that we run every week called What Else Have You Been Watching? So, Simon, I guess the question for you is, what else have you been watching?
Well, I'm still getting over some of Simon's incredible commentary. He was a terrific interview, so it's good that he was on the show, having not having spoken to him already. What else have I been watching? Well, I recorded on my, I downloaded from my Tubi app a little show called Fridays. Now, I don't know if you know of Fridays. I know exactly that you know of Fridays. But it was a show that was launched on the ABC network back in 1980 as kind of an answer to the success of Saturday Night Live. It's a late night comedy sketch show, and they had some very cool musical performances on it. I've watched the first few episodes of season one, and it is such a fast-paced and very funny look, not only at the day's events and you know, as a sketch comedy show, it works a treat, but it's got talent in there like Michael Richards, like Larry David. Comedian Rich Hall turns up. He's now relocated to Australia and is doing a lot of comedy work out here. Put together by two old school network live entertainment guys, Bill Lee and John Moffat, who John Moffat's still making stand-up specials, and features this incredible support cast. So it's I was a huge fan of this. I don't know how much you've seen of Fridays, Dan.
Look, I mean, maybe just like about 30 or 40 episodes.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you're ahead of me. That first episode had some of the funniest stuff in it. And done at such a sort of a heightened level, it was a little bit Monty Python-esque in some ways. And it opens with a very clever sketch about how they're not just trying to rip off Saturday Night Live, and then they cut to the cast all dressed in famous outfits from the Saturday Night Live team, like the Bee and the Coneheads and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, and the copies on Tubi all look terrific. So it's worth catching up. Seeing a very young Michael Richards do his shtick on television was a real treat.
Well, I think the real treat is watching Larry David doing sketch work. So the thing that I think a lot of people don't quite appreciate about Larry David is that he is a creature of sketch comedy. And so when he gets the opportunities to dress up in costumes and do silly things like that, he always jumps at it. Like, look at those crypto ads that he was doing like 2 years ago now. He got a lot of like crap from it. But I also think that the reason he did it was just purely let him play around in sketch and dress up as a Roman and, you know, all sorts of gear.
Yeah,
but watching this is fantastic because he's got big hair, big 70s. He's got like his big Jufro happening, which I think is fantastic. He's got that happening. But I guess my only exposure to Fridays before I ever watched the show was from, if you see the movie Man on the Moon, and there's the sequence where they're on a Saturday Night Live type show. It's actually Fridays that they're filming on. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Mm. That's interesting, because I had no idea that it had any pop culture sort of impact or reference other than being early work from Richards and Larry David. It also has a young lady in it called Melanie Chartoff, who's very lovely and very talented, and she was Robin in Seinfeld. She was George's girlfriend when he fights with the clown and pushes the granny out of the way in the fire at the kids' party. That's Melanie Chartoff's episode. So it's great to see her. Check out Fridays. If you have Tubi, Tubi's my go-to at the moment. It's the closest experience to wandering through a video store that you can find on the streaming platform. So lots of good stuff there.
Yeah, but a video store that only plays like low rent $3, you know, DVDs to buy.
Yeah, a video store. What else have you been watching, Dan Barrett?
Look, I wrote down a couple of things that I'd be talking about in a segment, but let's be honest, that was mostly aspirational. What's really happened is I've fallen into a very deep LA Law hole to the point where I've watched now, I don't know, 15 episodes in about 4 days. Like, it's been a wild couple of days for me. Yeah.
Well, I know that you mentioned that you'd been catching up on all the White Lotus as well, so you're having a bit of a retro.
That was a month or two ago. That was a while back. And White Lotus isn't retro, it's like current, like it's not really counting. I will express some frustration, literally that took place right now. While Simon was doing his Saltburn review, I was having a coughing fit and had to get myself some water. Shout out to the fine people at, what's it called, Love Glove, I think.
You can get that at IMAX, yeah.
Yeah, it's around the place. Delicious. This is the Yuzu sparkling water.
Very nice. What else have you been drinking?
Refreshing. But anyway, I went upstairs to get this elixir, and as I was walking up there, I passed my wife, who's taken a week sort of staycation, I think is the phrase. So anyway, I walked past and I'm like, oh, what are you watching? And she's like, oh, just the new episodes of The Crown.
Oh, Now that you're a married couple of certain years, all you've got is new television. That's all you have to share a shared experience now.
I know. She doesn't understand how rare this is, but whatever. I'm fine. So anyway, what else have I been watching? LA Law and not The Crown.
Not The Crown. And the other one you had in there, which I was very interested to talk to you about, is the new Disney Plus or Hulu story, A Murder at the End of the World, which is getting some of the best reviews I've read all year. So that's something maybe we can chat about at a later date.
I mean, the reviews have been fine. Maybe it just needs me to be needing to read more reviews, you know, we'll see. But anyway, Simon, let's move on to This Week in History.
November 19, 2006, Nintendo president Satoru Iwata launches what groundbreaking version of the home game console?
This was the Nintendo Wii, which... that's right, yep, okay. The thing with that Wii is this console completely changed my life.
Really?
Yeah.
You had a Wii?
Yeah, I had a Wii.
Yeah, I had a Wii too. We were given a Wii at the radio station I was working for. How did it change your life? How could it change your life?
Okay, so I had the Wii, and when I first put it, so it's 2006. It seems so silly and antiquated now talking about this being a life-changing moment for me, but it just shifted my perspective on the world at that point. So keep in mind, 2006 is pre-YouTube. So we suddenly had video online, but we didn't really have video online, not in a real sort of serious distribution way of content. But I remember putting on the Wii the very first time, and there were some videos that get played, which I think is just instructional guides on how to use the Wii. And as I was watching that, and they were streamed through the internet, they weren't things that were pre-built into the console. So when I saw that, I suddenly just realized the way that video could be distributed as a content form. Okay, and I'm like, well, you know, why can't massive libraries of content be distributed this way? So effectively, in my mind, I'd created Netflix in my mind before Netflix, you know, came about 5 years later. But for me, that was just that moment where I saw the proof of concept, and so I was able to wrap my mind around it with great ease, saying, oh, this is the future. And up until then, video piracy was something which was, you know, well and truly in my life. So I was certainly aware of watching TV content as distributed through the internet. But seeing something that was actually a live streamed product was something which was really quite new. And I hadn't really consciously thought too much about until I saw it with my own two peepers.
What was your favorite Wii game? Olympics or tennis or bowling? Aerobic? Were you into aerobics?
Well, what was the Mario game that was released for that one? That was Odyssey. I don't think I really liked that one so much.
Weird little sporting ones.
I don't know. I've played a lot of things on the Wii over the years.
You still have your Wii? Where do you Wii now?
I don't Wii so much. I've got a box that takes care of my Wii. I've moved on to other device. I couldn't work out how to connect that to urine. But anyway... I've got my Nintendo Switch now. It's different, better. Simon,
November 1982. Who is the 7-year-old that hosts? Now I'm coughing. Who is the 7-year-old that hosts tonight episode of Saturday Night Live?
Look, I'm not quite sure if she would have been 7 at this point, but it seems about right for era. This would be Drew Barrymore, right?
It was Drew Barrymore, yes. Yeah. The youngest to ever have hosted Saturday Night Live. What she was doing amongst that crowd, I don't know. Well, I do have some idea. November 24th, 1966, the Raquel Welch prehistoric adventure 1 million years BC has its global theatrical debut in which country?
So, look, I mean, the fact this question exists means that it's going to be somewhere unusual. So it's not America or probably even the UK. It's probably not any of that. So, look, easy money is probably just saying Australia, but, maybe it's, Zimbabwe. I don't know. Well, let's say Australia.
It was a relatively young country. It was called West Germany.
Right. That makes some sense.
I don't know why it debuted there. But it then spread out across the world and she became a huge star. Quiz this one.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
On the birthday quiz this week, Dan, now all of these actors are fairly well-travelled. The clue is it's in their movie titles, okay? November 18, 1968, Owen Wilson. November 19, 1961, the lovely Meg Ryan. November 22, 1967, Mark Ruffalo. And November 24, 1987, one of my favourite people in the world, Renata Rensve. You can see my interview with her on our YouTube channel. They all have had movies with titles that have something in common. What might it be?
Look, I was playing around with that worst person in the world, Maurice Heath, and it just led me nowhere. I'm stuck on this one. Can't do it.
Okay. You gave up pretty quick there. Let me just find the answer that I wrote for this. Okay.
Jeez.
They've all got international cities names in their titles. Let me explain this. Owen Wilson is very well traveled in his movie titles. He did The Grand Budapest Hotel, Midnight in Paris, The Darjeeling Limited, the Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Nights movies. Meg Ryan, of course, Sleepless in Seattle. Her first movie was Amityville 3D. And I guess at a stretch you could also say City of Angels, because that's Los Angeles, but it's not really. Mark Ruffalo was in Chicago 10, that animated story about the Chicago 10. And Renata Rensve had a support role in Oslo, August 31, which was the first film she made for her worst person in the world, director Joachim Trier. So there you go. That was a hard one to get. I had a lot of people this week that I couldn't put together. So, yeah, did good.
Okay, Simon, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Folks, thank you very much for listening. Just to give a quick recap as to what we did on this here pod. We did reviews. We looked at Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. I also took a look at the Cherry Tomato Boys in The Curse. You can find those ones respectively on Apple TV Plus and then over on the Paramount Plus. Simon, you did some movies.
I did The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, which is everywhere at the moment, this week's big release, and also the new film from Emerald Fennell called Saltburn with Barry Keoghan, also in generally wide release.
And then we had a chat with Simon Morado from, what's the name of the book? It's
Book of the Banned. It's a look at censorship through the years here in Australia, which sounds a bit dry. The book is not. It is actually a really entertaining read. And as you pointed out in the interview, he writes it in a very conversational style, which is makes it a really sort of brisk and entertaining read as well.
Yeah. I'd say it's rollicking.
Oh, it is rollicking. Yeah.
Mm. Anyway, folks, this is the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week with more.